Well, good afternoon, everybody. This is Bob Elson. We're set as usual for our Saturday afternoon show. And by the way, a lot of action in the Olympics today and tomorrow, and of course the big news was, and we were all delighted to see it, the United States beat the Russians last night at hockey, and that is the Russians' number one game. So that was quite an upset because the Russians were favorites, and the United States beat them, and that made everybody here happy. I don't know how they feel in Moscow, but we won't worry about that. Anyway, there are things on the tube today. DePaul plays Loyola, and a lot of Big Ten action, a lot of big game. Northwestern's at Michigan State, and DePaul and Loyola will play tonight, and that game will be seen on television on Channel 9 at 7:30. So there are a lot of things to do. And hockey this weekend, the Blackhawks are home. We're going to talk about baseball today with an old friend of ours and a man who is one of the outstanding trainers in the big leagues for many, many years, Ed Frohlich, who was with Joe McCarthy when Joe McCarthy was manager of the Cubs. That's a long time ago. Many of you will not remember that. But the biggest mistake the Cubs ever made was when they fired McCarthy. You go back right to that time, and that was the beginning of the Yankees. He went to New York. And the White Sox, or the Cubs, were in trouble for a long, long time. Anyway, we're going to talk baseball with Ed, and he'll be our guest in just about 1 minute. Well, we're delighted to have an old friend. We were on the baseball beat together for many, many years, Ed Frohlich, who was one of the top trainers in the big leagues for many, many years, and made a lot of friends, and did an excellent job in that capacity. So today we're going to talk baseball, and you know, it won't be too long, and baseball will be here. That's an absolute fact. And I see Charlie Finley's got himself a new manager, and they deserve each other. Billy Martin and Charlie Finley, that's a nice duo. Anyway, spring training will be here before you know it. So, speaking of that, Ed, spring training, I know that you were trainer under a number of managers. And I'm sure that different managers had different styles of approaching the spring training period and planned it differently. What about Joe McCarthy, who you and I are so fond of?
Well, Bob, I would say that his training camps were, like everything else he did, the best. When training started with the Yankees, you reported there, and it was just like as if you were going to play in the Yankee Stadium on the 4th of July. The workouts were short, they were crisp, but they were good. And if he caught anybody clowning, he would walk up very quietly behind them. He always knew how to approach you, and you didn't know he was around. And he'd walk up behind a person and he'd say, "The people here didn't come out to see clowns. If they want to see clowns, they'll drive 50 miles down the road to Sarasota, where the Ringling Brothers has the world's best." So everything that happened with the Yankees was good. And you'd do your work, you'd work hard, and then they always had taxi cabs waiting, and he'd send them home in threes and fours, and they'd be gone. Once you did your work, you didn't have to stand around and catch cold and stiffen up and all that sort of thing. So his workouts were probably the best of anybody, but like everything else with the Yankees, you know, they set the pattern for everything. So many clubs, there's a monotony and a boredom that sets in. Fellas are standing around 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon. They were really through with their heavy work at 1 o'clock, but here they are still standing around. Mm-hmm. And this is where the monotony comes in. You talk about different managers. They do different things differently. Lopez used to run pretty nice camps. It was a kind of a common sense approach to the things that he did. Grimes, I worked for Grimes, and of course Grimes' theory was a very Spartan one. He believed in working with fundamentals and spending a lot of hours in camp and all that sort of thing. But of course he didn't have, it comes down to talent. He had to spend a lot of hours with the clubs he had because he had a lot of Humpty Dumpties.
What do you think would have happened if the Cubs hadn't fired McCarthy?
The whole history of baseball would have been changed, Bob, because he had built a powerhouse. And it's no trick at all, once you build a powerhouse, to inject one new man each year into the lineup, and the rest of the club just takes that one fella and brings him up to their level. their greatness. And so with the kind of a club that the Cubs had built, Kyler and Stevenson and Wilson and Hartnett and Hornsby and Grimm, my God, that was a tremendous club. It was probably the greatest right-handed hitting club in the history of baseball, without question. And because they hit the ball to the opposite field, it was like as if they were a left-handed hitting club.
Yeah.
So if that club had been left intact, I think the whole history of baseball would have been changed, because I think a lot of those championships that the Yankees won, the Cubs would have won.
Doc, what is your theory, or what did you hear? Why was McCarthy fired?
Well, he told me the story himself, and it was just one of those little peculiar things that happen in human relations. The Cubs are coming home from the World Series in 29, and Mr. Wrigley, William Wrigley Jr., P.K. Wrigley's father, was sitting in a diner, and they were coming home from the series, and in a kind of an offhand remark, he made the remark to Irving Vaughn that maybe Sunday he would have a manager who would win a World Championship for him. And everything was forgot. Next year, as the season was drawing to a close, McCarthy had lost Hal Carlson through death, and Hornsby broke a leg, and Root had a sore arm all year, and he still only lost the pennant by a game and a half. But as the season was drawing to a close, Mr. Wrigley and Mr. Vaughn were talking, and Vaughn brought out the remark again. He said, do you still feel the same way you did last fall when we were coming home from the series? And he backed him into a corner and more or less forced him to make a change. And so he nominated Hornsby, and when McCarthy left, he gave him $10,000 worth of Wrigley stock. Now think about that. That was 50 years ago what that stock was worth. He gave him $10,000 worth of Wrigley stock, and he told him at the time, he said, I know I'm making a mistake. He said, I'm doing this, and I know I'm making a mistake. And it turned out he did.
Well, that was really being honest about it, wasn't it? Well, now, you've been around baseball for as long as I have. How many different ways are there to play the game? What can one manager, say, Stengel, do that McCarthy didn't do, or Lopez did do, or so on and so forth?
Well, there was, to put it briefly, there's one way to play baseball, which is McCarthy's way, and then there's all the rest. Nobody did it the way he did it, and I can qualify that by saying, what made him great? I can sum it up for you in one sentence. You could never exploit McCarthy's ball club's weakness. He wouldn't allow it. He wouldn't let you. But he could always exploit your weakness. And this is the sum and substance of the difference between him and other managers. You could never find his weak spot or exploit it. And this is the difference.
I remember one of Joe McCarthy's sayings, because I was close to him and you were close to him. He said, when the other side hits a double play ball, you better make that double play or you're going to learn to make it in Jersey City.
That's right. That's right. That's right. They were playing a spring training game one day, and Shartak was playing right field, and Shartak was potentially a great ball player. They thought he was going to be the person that would take Gehrig's place. Big, strong, power, throw. And it developed that he didn't, but he was playing right field this day, and he threw a runner out of third base in the first inning. Two innings later, he made another great throw, threw a runner out at the plate, and a couple innings later, he threw another runner out of third base, and when he came into the dugout, as he walked past McCarthy, he pulled him by the pant leg, and he said, sit down. And very quietly, so that no one else heard, he said, you loafed on that last ball. He said, you fielded the ball on the third hop. The ball should have been fielded on the second hop, and you made a close play out of what shouldn't have been a close play. And I don't like close plays because the umpire might miss it. Don't make close plays on this club. Here the guy had made three great throws, threw out three runners in five innings, and he was being told that he didn't make the play right. Well, of course, this was McCarthy. He strove for perfection, and he came closest to getting it of anybody I ever knew. It was perfection. He wanted perfection, and he strived for it all the time.
You know, it's a strange thing. We both know, because I was around when McCarthy was managing, and you were with him when he was managing a club. And in spite of his demands for the players, he had a personal weakness. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, Bob. every year, sometime in the middle of the season, you could figure that maybe for about 3 or 4 days or something like that, he would go off on a little bender. Yeah. And this was it. This was it. It had to happen. And it was the pressure. He was the greatest person with the greatest self-control on a bench I ever saw in my life. Just tremendous. But of course, no one, you know, there has to be an escape valve there someplace or you blow your top. Yep. You know, the top of your head just explodes. So every year, along about sometime in the middle of the season, somewhere around the 4th of July or thereabouts, you could figure that for 3 or 4 days, he would go off on a bender, and the players used to dread it. Because then was the time when he would remind them of something that they didn't do in April. And if they saw it coming, they'd say, uh-oh, it'll be tough for the next 3 or 4 days.
I can remember one of the incidents because it happened at Sox Park. He happened to be on a bender when the Yankees came in here, and I went in the clubhouse to visit him, and they had him sitting in a shower, you know, and the water was pouring on him for, I don't know, a half hour or an hour. But, boy, he was a wonderful man, and I really loved that guy. And he was, I think, the greatest manager I ever saw.
Without a doubt, Bob, without a doubt. The toughest part was trying to keep him away from the ballpark when he was that way. He still wanted to go to the ballpark. And if he, you know, if you could have just kept him away from the ballpark, all you have to tell the press is he has the flu.
Yeah.
He has the flu. He has intestinal flu, and he can't leave his room. He wanted to be at that ballpark. He's a great man.
Yeah.
Great man.
Well, he really was a great man. I'll tell you, he certainly made a great contribution to baseball. How do you view the latest Finley escapade?
Bob, there's no question but what Martin's a great manager. No question of doubt in anybody's mind. The question that arises is Finley likes to be pretty active in the club's functions. And the question in my mind is, what is Martin going to say the first time Finley suggests a lineup? this is the thing that I have in the back of my mind, because Martin's a pretty strong-willed guy. His ball club is his ball club. That's his private domain.
Well, he's always been a terrific competitor, and the game's going to be played one way, the way he wants it played.
Exactly, you know, exactly. And if he stays any length of time with the Oakland club, you can bet that the Oakland club will be a better ball club. Because the guy's track records proves it. You know, he's won any place he's ever been. He's won any place he's ever been. I had a little incident with when he was at Minnesota and Martin had picked up Leo Cardenas, remember the shortstop?
Yeah.
And I was talking to him one day, and I said, "You're going to be a better ball player here than you were at Cincinnati." He said, "What makes you so sure?" I said, "Because if you aren't, Martin will punch you full of holes." And he said, "You're right. You're right."
Yeah, he's a tough little guy, but as you say, he should do a great job as manager. Our guest today is Ed Frohlich, who spent years and years as a trainer in Big League Baseball, and we'll be back with our guest in just a moment. Our guest today is Ed Frohlich, former Big League trainer for many, many years here in Chicago, and he was with the late Joe McCarthy, one of the greatest managers that ever lived. Doc, what about the problem, and that was your concern, and I used to come into the clubhouse after a ball game and after when you looked like you'd been drawn through a keyhole. I mean, you really looked tired out, rubbing the players and the pitcher and all that sort of thing. It really is a lot of work.
Yes, it is, Bob. And, of course, I used to dread spring training because it's the toughest time of the year. You know, your responsibility is to come away from spring training without any sore arms or sore legs. Because if you come away from training camp and you've got a sore arm or a sore leg, you can figure that you will have it all year. It's that kind of a thing. It's a hairy, scary time of the year. And if you don't get away from the barrier right, you're going to have a tough time of it. It's also the time of the year, Bob, when players establish their mental attitude for the year, and you can tell. You know, they either come ready to go and ready to do things, or they don't. And you can sense this in training camp. And this, of course, is where a trainer can come into the picture, because you're close to the players and you're dealing with them all the time, and you have a chance to say a lot of things, you know, that might be helpful. But the big thing is the business of preparing the club. And my theory was that I always wanted every pitcher to come in and see me before he went on the field each day, because I would stretch his arm and I would apply a medicated ointment, an analgesic ointment to his shoulder and his arm, and I figured then he was at least protected for the rest of the day. I used to say, if you don't come in to see me all the rest of the day, it's all right with me, but I do want to see you before you step on the field, because this would prepare him.
Yeah.
Pitchers and catchers especially. And then, of course, you know, you worry and you have to be careful with each pitcher, because each one is an individual case. You can't lay down a hard and fast rule and say, everybody is going to pitch 5 minutes of batting practice today. Everybody's going to pitch 10 minutes of batting practice today, because your staff doesn't progress evenly. Maybe six or seven fellows are in one group. Maybe one or two are behind them. Now, you have to know that these two fellows have to be held back. You've got to hold them back a day or two, because they have excessive soreness. And if you push them, you're going to have soreness for the rest of the year. That's when they can get hurt.
I'm going to test your memory and see how good your memory is now. There was a pitcher, and he was a great pitcher. He used to be sitting in front of his locker, and this was the days when they would roll your own cigarettes, you know, Bull Durham or whatever they called it. And he'd light a cigarette, and then he'd reach up in the locker and get a bottle of Sloan's Liniment in his left hand, and then he'd very slowly and meticulously rub that on his right shoulder. And then he'd go down in the field. He'd be back in about an hour and 20 minutes with another victory. Who was that?
Grover Cleveland Alexander.
That's who it was.
Grover Cleveland Alexander.
He would sit there, Bob, and he'd stare at the clock. He'd watch the clock, And 15 minutes before the game was supposed to start, he would take that big, tall bottle of Sloan's Liniment and slowly pat it on his shoulder and his arm. And then he'd take one more cigarette. And then with 10 minutes left, he'd start for down the field, and he'd warm up. And watching him warm up was the most amazing thing you ever saw. He'd throw a ball, and then he'd look at the stands and see who was in the stands. And then he might spit in his glove and soften his glove. Then he'd throw another ball. And Fletcher told me the story about the first time he ever saw him warming up. Fletcher was a kind of a firebrand kind of a ball player. And he didn't think he was getting ready properly. And Fletcher, of course, was a rookie. Alec was already an established star. And Fletcher watched this, and he finally walked up to him and he said, "When are you going to throw hard? The game's about ready to start." And Alexander looked at him and he said, "When I get out there in the middle of that diamond, that's when I'll throw hard."
Well, he was a great one. I guess he has to be one of the five greatest right-handers of all time, wouldn't you say?
Without a doubt. Probably for me, the greatest pitcher. If I had to have somebody pitch one game for my life, he's the one I'd want to pitch.
You take him over Walter Johnson?
Well, I saw more of him than I saw of Johnson, but I guess you wouldn't be bad off with either one. But they tell a story about him walking into Wrigley Field one day when Killifer was running the club, and he was just absolutely stoned. And Killifer took one look at him, and he said, "You're still pitching today." And Alexander said, "Who said I wasn't?" One hit. Shut up. One hit. Who said I wasn't?
Were there any other characters around like him that you can think of? Gomez was a character, wasn't he?
Yeah, but there was nobody like Alexander. But Alexander, of course, there wasn't a whole lot of humor to Alexander. There wasn't a whole lot of humor, except once in a while, you know. I remember one time McCarthy was telling them about they were getting ready to play the Cardinals. And the Rabbit Moranville was on the Cardinals, and McCarthy said, when he gets on second base, he said, "Be sure and use a switch sign, because he's pretty cagey, and he'll be giving the hitters a sign." And he noticed Alexander kind of nodding in the back of the room. It was in the spring of the year, hot, and he'd been out late the night before. And he jumped all over Alec. He said, "It wouldn't do you any harm to stay awake and pay attention to what's going on." Well, Alec had caught, you know, he wasn't completely asleep. He said, "Joe, if I'm pitching and you see Moranville on second base," he said, "don't waste any time. Come out there and get me out, because you know I don't have my stuff."
Oh, gee, there were Well, you were with the Yankees when Gomez was there, weren't you? They say that he was the only clown that McCarthy put up with.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he liked Gomez. He liked Gomez, and he would put up with a lot of things from Gomez that he wouldn't put up with somebody else. The only thing he didn't like about Gomez would drive him crazy on the bench. You know, he'd hang like a monkey and all that sort of thing, and finally McCarthy'd get a belly full of it, and he'd say, "Lefty, go down and loosen up. I might use you in the late innings." He wasn't going to use him as a relief pitcher. He just wanted to get rid of him.
Well, those were really some years.
But the classic about Gomez and him is it was toward the finish of his career, and the starts were not coming very frequently, and so this day in Washington, he finally got a start, and the Yankees jumped out to a 6-run lead in the top of the inning. Washington comes to bat, and Jerry Walker tried to bunt a ball. He's like the first hitter, and he fouled the ball off his eye. Now there's blood coming out of his eye, and they're trying to stop the bleeding, and the game is being held up, and it's hot. And finally, McCarthy yelled at him. He said, "Lefty, come in here and sit down while they make up their mind what they're going to do." And Gomez was standing on the mound. He said, "You're not getting me out of here that easy." He said, "It took me 6 weeks to get this start." And he said, "And I'm staying right here."
You remember Ruffing. He was a great right-hander.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Great. Absolutely great. And a great World Series pitcher. Tell about the time that it was the day before the World Series, a couple of days before the World Series started, and he walked in the clubhouse, and there was a big cluster of Yankee pitchers gathered around one locker, and there's a conversation. He looked over and he said, "What's the summit meeting all about?" And somebody said, "We're just talking about who's likely to start the World Series." And he said, "Who's likely to start the World Series?" He said, "The same guy that always starts the World Series around here, Ruffing. That's who's going to start the World Series." And that's the way it was.
You know, before a World Series, usually a club has a scout with the opposing club for a couple of weeks to get a line on the hitters and so on and so forth. How well, in your knowledge and experience of that sort of thing, did those kind of books on the hitters hold up?
It holds up pretty good, Bob. It holds up pretty good. They scout a hitter pretty good and all that sort of thing. But it's surprising a lot of times how sometimes the obvious thing can be missed. And I think particularly in the World Series in 1947, Whit Matthews of the Dodgers followed the Yankees for half the season. And when the World Series started, the Dodgers pitched Lindell low. And he killed him. He hit 500 until he went on to line up with a couple of cracked ribs in the sixth game. On the other hand, the Dodgers, and we had scouted the Dodgers, Jackie Robinson killed us the first three games. And finally, DiMaggio told me, he said, "He's going to beat us if we don't start pitching him a little bit differently." We were pitching away from him. DiMaggio was the one that noticed it from center field. He said, "You can't pitch him that way." And he finally told the ball club, and they changed. They started to pitch him inside. They slowed him down, and, of course, we won. So here was two outstanding examples, Bob. Both clubs had scouted each other and missed completely on these two fellas. You see, it can happen.
Yeah, I should say so. Our guest today, and we're delighted to have him, is an old friend, Ed Frohlich, a top trainer in the major leagues for many, many years. We'll be back with our guest in just a moment. Our guest today, and we're delighted to have him, is Ed Frohlich, an old friend and former big league trainer. Spent many years with Joe McCarthy, one of the great, if not the greatest manager of all time. I often think, Ed, about the thing you and I have discussed so many times. What would have happened to the Cubs if they hadn't fired McCarthy? They would have had some great years, wouldn't they?
Without a doubt, Bob. Without a doubt. They had, you know, built the ball club. The attendance was there. The players were there. And all they had to do was just inject a new player from time to time and just go on with what they had. They had the powerhouse pitching, and they had defense, and they had hitting. Like, of course, you know, no club other than the Yankees of 1927 would compare with them. And the A's, I guess, of 1929, 30, and 31 would compare with them. But those three clubs were in a class, I think, by themselves as far as hitting was concerned. And that Cub team would compare with anybody when it came to the bat.
Yeah, they really had it. You know, I have people ask me all the time, what's different about the game of baseball in the 45 or 50 years that you spend in it? I always say, in my opinion, and it's just mine, the accent on relief pitching.
That probably is true, Bob. Years ago, pitchers used to have to go nine innings.
And wanted to go nine innings
because, well, we had a perfect example of it on the Yankees, and I remember one time we had Chandler. And Chandler, a lot of that, Bob, is just a frame of mind. You know, you've got a good relief pitcher, so you're going to let him pitch the eighth and ninth. But if you're that kind of a pitcher, sooner or later, the club is going to dock you for it. You know, they call you a seven-inning pitcher, and they say that they pay you and also a relief pitcher. So this is just a frame of mind, and a lot of pitchers today that only pitch seven innings really could pitch nine if there wasn't somebody out there ready to take their place.
That's right. Our guest today, and thanks, Doc, for being with us.
It's been nice being with you, Bob.
We've been talking baseball with an old friend, Ed Folick, one of the top trainers in the major leagues. So have a happy day, and now this is Bob Elson saying goodbye until next weekend at our usual time.